No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
Hello, and that was Sweet Honey in the Rock. We'd give their people the right to vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important and affect the lives of all of us. And today we have a fun guest and a very special guest, Dr. Paul Harrison. Dr. Harrison is a senior lecturer and the unit chair of consumer behavior in the Department of Marketing at Deakin Business School. Dr. Harrison, his research is focused on emotional and rational behavior and how our biology and environment interact to influence the way we make decisions. His work has been published in a wide range of international journals and conference proceedings, and he has informed policy and business practices in Australia and internationally. Dr. Harrison, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Senator Brown.
Well, you know, the first thing I want to say is that I said this to you before the show. We spent a lot of time wringing our hands and talking about what we did wrong. That, you know, Kamala should have gone on the Joe Rogan show, or we should have said this about the economy. We should have said that. But we really haven't talked about us, what we did to elect this man who wants to be a dictator, basically. And I want to focus on that. Who are we that we've elected this man? Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons we are really anxious to get you on the show. So maybe you can tell us, because I'm really interested, this is a big question, how our biology and the environment actually do interact to influence the way we make decisions. What's that about?
Well, I think the first thing to start with is this misunderstanding that we have about how we make choices and how we make decisions. And I think, you know, the first thing we need to kind of recognize is that most of our decision making is not done at a rational level. And there's a reason for that. The reason is because it's quite effortful and energy sapping to actually fire up that thinking brain, that prefrontal cortex part of the brain. And so what happens is that the brain, most of the time, most of our decision making is happening outside of our reflective awareness, outside of our kind of decision making. And most of the time, it's an emotional decision. And the funny thing is that what ends up happening is that even when we make an emotional decision, we've got this thinking brain that needs to remind us that we're good thinkers. So it comes and then rationalizes why we're doing what we're doing. So the sequence is usually an automatic response, kind of driven by some kind of stimuli, some kind of lived experience, or something that kind of feels deep, deep down, you know, that this is the right thing to do. We make the decision, and then we have the kind of process of looking for reasons why we've made this decision. And so even if you're talking to people afterwards, and this is one of the problems with polling and kind of attitude-based surveys, is that if you ask people why they do what they do, most of the time we don't really have access to that information because it's happening implicitly. It's happening outside our conscious awareness. So that's the first kind of foundation that we have to establish what's going on. I think with any form, and we can talk about this a lot more, Mike, but I think any form of decision-making is also then informed by the kind of external environment. And I think, you know, over time, what we've had happen in pretty much Western culture, and, you know, you might kind of say capitalist culture, is that those figures, those things that we've looked up to in the past, which probably used to be kings and leaders and maybe, you know, for many people, the kind of God and things like that, they've been replaced by what we probably would say is celebrities, because they're where we get access to information. They're the ones that we want to emulate. It is really just a replacement of those authority figures with these pretty much, and I hate to say it, but these social media influencers, reality TV stars, people who we see all the time.
Well, you know, I've been saying much of what you just said for years. I've been saying, not in the same terms, I've been saying that you know, I think people go out and look. They don't look for information. They look for validation of their prejudices, you know, that you don't like this or you don't like that. So you go out and you go, oh, yeah, you know, I don't like that race of people. And I saw that guy do something. They use all this anecdotal information. I saw that guy do this or that, you know, and that. So I think that is really, really an important thing in our, and I don't, in the way we interact with each other, and I never really connected it to any kind of internal mechanism that we have, and it's nice to know that there is that connection, but also that I think that people go out in the environment. For example, you get somebody, Donald Trump says, all these people are sneaking in over the border and taking our jobs. So you go to McDonald's and you're talking to the clown's mouth, you know, to order something, and the person on the other end has a really heavy accent and you have a hard time understanding them. And then that's your validation. You go, oh, there we go. They're taking another one of our jobs. Yep. You know, even though you wouldn't work at a McDonald's for all the money in the world, you know, it doesn't matter. It's, you know, you're getting that stimuli from the environment. So that's why celebrities, though. What is it about celebrities that we find so attractive? Do you know?
Well, I mean, I think you brought up two really interesting elements there too, Mike. And I'll get onto why we like celebrities so much. But I this is something, because, you know, in Australia, we've watched the US election from afar as well. And I think the critical thing about anecdotes and is that we're actually wired to notice things that stand out. So your example of the McDonald's is an excellent example. It's something that because I run the MBA program at Deakin, and we teach our MBA students is that this is actually normal to notice these things. So, you know, the example might be the McDonald's, or when you get on a train or public transport, you notice the people who seem different from your social group. And the reason is partly related to social identity, which is this idea of who am I, what do I represent, who's my group, which also feeds into what we call in-group and out-group bias. And the evolutionary reason for that, for noticing people who are different, is that we look for safety within our own social group. So, you know, eons ago, generations ago, we didn't get exposure to lots of people who look different. And so what we do is we protect ourselves by saying our enemy, to some degree, is people who aren't the same as us. So we seek to kind of categorize people on those similarities and differences. And then those immediate emotional reactions, those impressions, shape how we respond to them. So these are social biases. They influence what we pay attention to. But it also then makes us realize that we have to kind of be cautious about generalizing from a few striking observations. And watching this process, really, whether he knew it or not, and I'd actually probably say he didn't, it's probably all gut feeling, what Donald Trump did was he played into those human biases. It's clever, but it's not. I think I'm always grappling with this because I don't think it's strategic. I think it's, from his perspective, it's just that he knows, you know, what works and what doesn't. And this thing is that our brain is very quick to notice unusual examples of things. And then, because we're pattern-seeking creatures, we actually then look for information that kind of fits with that pattern. And we have another bias, which you mentioned, which is this idea of the confirmation bias, which is that we look for and we interpret and we recall information that recalls our previous beliefs, our kind of the things that we think are true through things like selective attention. So we only notice the things that align with our beliefs, selective interpretation. So what we do is that we, if information is ambiguous, we'll interpret it and develop it to suit our current existing beliefs. And so a great example would be something like going to a football game. If a referee's call is biased against your team, or if the referee's call is neutral, you think it's biased against your team. And then the last one is selective memory, which is we tend to remember information that supports our view, and we very quickly get rid of information that contradicts it. And as I was kind of saying earlier, it all is built around this idea of cognitive efficiency, which means that if we're only remembering the things that confirm our biases, it requires less effort. It makes us feel comfortable emotionally. And then the groups that we belong to create these echo chambers and keep reinforcing it. And I think that's another really critical element of our current state, which is that we're being drawn further and further into a form of truth, which is really driven by our echo chambers. So all of this is, you know, to use the kind of common approach, is a perfect storm for people who are celebrities, people who are well-known, people who talk to your beliefs, your prejudices. They're the ones who are going to have the strongest effect. And whether it was Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, both of them spoke to their audiences and reinforced that. And I think the difficulty you have, particularly in the US, is that, first of all, you know, voting is not compulsory. So not everybody's forced to kind of make a choice. This isn't my idea, but, you know, a very small proportion basically elect pretty much the president of the country, but also, you know, affects the rest of the world. And that's a really significant factor, is that it's actually not about all of the people who are, you know, rusted on Republicans or rusted on Democrats. It's the people who, for whatever reason, move backwards and forwards between those particular points of view.
Well, and I guess that's why it was so effective. You know, it's very old strategy, as you point out, you know, that the problem is not you, it's your neighbor. One of my political mentors was a guy named Huey Long, who was kind of a corrupt but benevolent senator from Louisiana who got assassinated on the floor of the Senate. But he used to say, there are 100,000 Frenchmen in New Orleans. Your house could burn down, your baby could drown, and not one of those Frenchmen would care. And that was his campaign, kind of his campaign slogan. Yeah, and, you know, and and the other thing you said, I don't know where you've been all my life, doctor, but I've said this all the time, too, that my grandmother, you know, my grandmother was prejudiced, and she wouldn't, if a minority person gave her a kidney, she wouldn't remember it, but she would remember every one of them she ever saw cashing a welfare check in a liquor store, you know, because that, right? Because that reinforced what she believed. And no amount of evidence, you know, you couldn't present any kind of statistics to her that would sway her, you know. And I think this is one of the problems we've had as Democrats. You know, we come out and we go, well, the economy's not bad. The economy's doing better than any other economy in the world. But for most people, the economy in the United States is the price of bread, and the price of milk, and the price of gas. It's not the stock market. It's not unemployment. It's not, you know, it's the price of everyday goods, and we don't address that. So let me ask you something.
Sorry to interrupt, Mike, but I think it's not what the real prices are, it's how the prices feel. So I think this is the other thing, is that, you know, people don't go into the supermarket and go write down what the price of bread is on a Monday and then write down what it is. If it feels like the prices are going up, then that becomes a form of truth. And that form of truth then feeds everything. But again, like you say, if we're already believe that the government is bad, and we notice the price going up on one thing and it feels like the price has gone up, but we completely ignore all the other things that have gone down in price, that actually is a very efficient way for our brain to work, because it means that we don't have to think too much. And I think, you know, this is another thing, is that it's a natural human instinct to avoid thinking. People like me, like I have, my job is to think, but I think a lot of people would prefer, and people say this very clearly, it's like, I don't want to think, I want to escape.
Right.
And so most people are not as engaged with politics as you are, because it's your job, but a very small proportion of the population have an interest in politics, and they really only take notice when they're forced to.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that, and you know, we see it all the time, and again, I think we've turned a blind eye to that, and we've kind of been hoisted on our own petard, to quote the bard, because we're kind of arrogant as Democrats, so we feel that all we need to do is explain it to you, and you will see our point of view, right? That you don't want a gun. You really don't want a gun. You're just too damn stupid to realize that. So let us explain to you why you don't need it, and don't want it. And that's really, really a big problem we have. We don't play to the audience sometimes. We just like to hear ourselves talk. Let me ask you: Is this guy really, really clever? Because he is nominating nothing so far for his cabinet except other celebrities. Dr. Oz is a celebrity, right? Mrs. McMahon, the woman that owns the wrestling guys, she's a celebrity. Elon Musk, Kennedy is a celebrity just because he's a Kennedy. You really don't even have to do anything else to be a celebrity, right? So... yeah, so what's that? Is he just brilliant and realizes that if he nominates celebrities, some of these things that you're talking about will come into play and people will support him? Because that's what it's all about. If, regardless of what the senators feel like, if they think people are supporting his nominations, they'll go ahead and confirm whether they think you're right or not. To hell with advising consent. It's all about, what's popular and what's not. So do you think this is a brilliant move on his part to do celebrities, or these are just the people he knows?
Look, it's hard to know because I'm not in his head, but yeah. From as an outsider, I think, to me, it feels like a bit of trolling. He's angry about what happened to him. He's angry about the way that he's been treated by the kind of progressive perspective, and he, in a way, he's saying, first of all, partly because, and we know this is not a new perspective, is that he's relatively thin-skinned. I mean, one of the critical things, and just to kind of give some context, is that all humans are desperately don't want to be ignored. We want to be noticed. We want to be remembered. And different people pursue that desire to be noticed and remembered and not ignored in different ways. And if you think about it, probably what's happened in all of our lives is that we've picked up on a few things that have fed into our idea of what it is to be successful. And success in context leads to being noticed, which leads to being loved. And I think this is the thing, is in the end, we all want to be loved. We want to be loved by the people around us. We want to be loved by others. This is what drives a huge amount of human behavior. From Donald Trump's perspective, what he's doing partially is he's kind of creating a cabinet of people, partially maybe that he knows are going to be loyal, because again, if we think that most of the decisions that we make are not really that rational, so he feels like they're going to be loyal because, you know, maybe they're on television and they've talked about him in a positive way, so there's that. But on top of that, what he's doing is he's probably, there's just anger a lot of anger driving it. And I think, you know, you may be familiar with Robert Keegan's kind of levels of different types of cognitive behavior or cognitive human adult development. But what I kind of look at with somebody like Keegan is he's in what we kind of call the stage two area of adult development, which is this idea of what's called the imperial stage. So for that kind of level of adult development, the person in that stage is very much very self-centered. They're focused on their own needs, their own interests and their desires. Most relationships are transactional. Most people at this stage might be aware of what people think of them, but that perception is motivated by how it might directly affect them, as opposed to having, I guess, what you would think is a much broader mindset around this idea of what do I want to do outside of me. And I think, you know, a significant proportion of people do stay in that what we call the adolescent or the imperial stage. And I think that's where he's at. I don't think that he is a, you know, Machiavellian mind. I'll stand. This is my perception, and it's this idea of from the outside, it doesn't look like a lot of what is being done is particularly strategic. Now, I don't know. I've sat in boards. I'm on a range of boards. I've sat in meetings with high level executives. So much of that decision making is not done really at a strategic level. It's done at a kind of gut feeling, this is what's worked in the past kind of level. The businesses that I've advised and consulted to, generally speaking, you know, a lot of it is about saying, well, this is what you want to achieve, how do you want to get there, rather than necessarily saying, this is what happens when I talk to them. But a lot of the time they say, well, this is what we do, and how do we make what we do fit how we want to get there. And I think the issue that I'm kind of grappling with here is that the president of the United States, or the kind of president-elect of the United States, has been able to convince people, first of all, that they know what they're doing, and second of all, to be able to convince people that they're going to be okay with him as the president. And that is really kind of built around this idea of you know, feeding into people's perceptions of how they see themselves and what they see as a powerful leader. And, you know, I know I'm jumping all over the place. I feel like I'm Donald Trump doing that weave kind of thing. But I think this is the thing, is that it's a really complicated mess. But to go back to your original question, I don't think it's strategic. I think it's accidental. I think that there's an element of probably him seeing the people who's in front of him right now. It's kind of like, you know, these are the people who he sees. These are the people who support him. In a way, it's trolling the Democrats. I think there's an element of that. It's getting a little bit of, payback to the Democrats. And it's then also how can I then punish those people who were mean to me? And it is that thing. And it's kind of like there is an element of adolescence, this is not fair, that goes on in the discourse that is often spoken, even at that kind of Republican level, is that we have a lot of teenagers, men in their 60s and 70s, yeah, who are behaving like teenagers.
Yeah,
we do. Although I do know some really lovely teenagers who are incredibly wise. If anything, this kind of generation of adolescents is probably the wisest I've ever come across.
Well, and you know what? In the United States, people like me, I'm 71 years old, I mourn for younger people, because you're right, there are teenagers out there that are just brilliant, and I know some of them. I have children. I know you have children. I have two daughters. You have two daughters, and I have a son. And yeah. and I lament that I'm not handing over the same country to them that was handed to me by my parents, you know, that even though I struggled as a child, I grew up in a world where I got out of college and I didn't ever think about getting a job. You know what I mean? I thought no matter what I did, I would find a job, you know, that I would find something I liked and something interesting. My kids now, they, you know, they're well out of college. And you know, they're not sure what their next step will be and what will be out there for them. And you know, I really feel bad about that. And it amazes me that you've got a guy that's a billionaire that got $100 million from his father that's never worked in his life. First decent job I ever had was as a Teamster. And the Teamsters were at that the head of the Teamsters union spoke on his behalf at the Republican convention. The Teamsters have never even attended the Republican convention, but he's convinced working class people that he can feel their pain. I don't know exactly how he's done that. They just, the auto manufacturers just announced that they're going to lay off 1,000 people. So, but that, you know, those are the people that voted for him. They've, you know, how he's done that, I don't know. Let me ask you about familiarity. How much does that play in a role in things? That, you know, he's been in our living room for 16 years now. He started The Apprentice in 2008. And so he's been a celebrity. You know, it's really the only thing he's ever was really successful at. You know, his social media thing has failed. His Bibles from China business has failed. His steak knife business has failed. His college failed. Most of his real estate stuff has failed. You know, but he's really exceeded as a celebrity. And he's been a celebrity for 16 years on our homes. So how much do you think that plays into it? That people didn't know who Kamala Harris was. She was a vice president. She was the understudy. She wasn't, you know, she wasn't out there on stage. She was in the wings. So, but Donald, one thing you got to say about the Donald is he's always in your face and he's always got the media attention. So how much do you think that plays in? Does that make people feel more comfortable that they know who you are?
It's a huge factor, Mike, and I think this is a thing that we misunderstand. And look, I think the tricky thing is familiarity. We have to think about familiarity in a very complicated way. Just being in somebody's face all the time doesn't necessarily achieve what we think. But there's a term I'm going to use called cognitive fluency, and basically what it is, it's the brain's ability or desire to rely on ease of processing. So if we are seeing something repeatedly, eventually it becomes easier for us to process it. And then this familiarity creates a sense of comfort. It kind of makes us feel comfortable. It makes us feel like this is a form of truth. It takes on a form of truth. And so there's another element that I always think, which is, And this is, I guess, where the whole idea of intervening when we see bad things happening is really important early on, is that if people don't correct it early on, then it becomes harder and harder to change people's minds. And so what ends up happening, and we see this in things like conspiracy theories, and, you know, this is why they kind of gain traction, is because the more something is repeated, the more familiar they become, and the more that our brains mistake that familiarity for a form of truth. Being in front of you for a long period of time gives somebody credibility. And the reason it gives them credibility is because some people, the way we process this is that at some point, if he's not telling the truth, somebody would have stepped in and corrected this. Or why is he on television? Or why is he in our living rooms? If he's in our living room, somebody somewhere must have said, this is okay. And this is, you know, partially the authority bias as well. It's like we're looking to our institutions to help us to understand how we should operate in the world. So familiarity, huge factor in decision-making. There's a really interesting study done by a colleague of mine, Stuart Roper, at Manchester University, where he basically exposed people, without them knowing consciously, to a particular colour as they walked from their home to a service station, a gas station. And it was a colour purple. And what it did is Cadbury's, which is a chocolate brand, it this colour purple basically at an unconscious level influenced the type of chocolate that they would choose. So at an unconscious level, we're being affected by all of the stimuli around us. Our brain says, well, I'm seeing this thing a lot, so it must be good. It must be okay because familiar, so I will now choose it. Again, this happens at an emotional level. We kind of then build a whole bunch of elements that are, again, outside of our conscious level to help reinforce that. So by the time we walk into the ballot box and take our vote, the decision is already made. And I think this is the misunderstanding that we have about the way that people vote. Most people's decision is made well and truly before election day, even those people who say, I'm still deciding. Most people's decisions are made well before that, and it's not based on rational information. It's based on how they feel. It's based on their kind of experienced feelings of things and their perceptions of things, and it's not necessarily based on policy. And I think, you know, you've brought this up, Mike, is that most people aren't that interested in policy. They're interested in how they feel about what seems to be, in inverted commas, policy.
Yeah, well, that, you know, we really have to understand that that was our Achilles heel in this election, because we had a guy that won the election resoundingly who really didn't talk about policy. He just said, I'm going to make, you know, I'm going to take care of women whether they like it or not. You're going to feel wonderful. You're going to, you know, everything's going to be magical. Well, how? Well, I'm just going to do it. You know, I mean, to the point where it's absurd, Professor, where, you know, they asked him on a, you know, he professes to be a Christian, and they asked him on a Christian radio show whether he was an Old Testament or a New Testament person. And he said he was more of an e-books guy. He's more of an e-books guy. He doesn't even understand that Bible has two parts. I mean, you know, well, I made my confirmation at 7 years old, and I realized that. So it's just gotten to be crazy. But let me ask you to put on your consultant hat for a minute. I've hired you.
Sure.
I have some big conference. I've read your stuff. I think that, you know, I want to do something about this bias in the way we think about things. What can we do to mitigate some of the things you're talking about, or is there anything we can do? I mean, is there any strategy that we can employ? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think that, and this is the thing, because I'm an academic, I'll come at you with the scientific explanation rather than a consultant. The role of a consultant is to get their money out of you. I think this is the thing. Exactly. And like, you know, I have many friends who work in consulting, and one of them who I adore, she always says, we're babysitters for business. And I think that's a really kind of, you know, it is about taking away the pain of decision making. As a scientist, I think it's effortful, and it will take a lot of work. But I think it's always about, I guess for me, it's about investment. And so I would never suggest run some ads. I would never suggest, you know, anything that is going to give you a short-term kind of sugar hit. That's what advertising agencies are really good at doing, but we know it doesn't work. One thing to kind of know, too, is that most advertising tends to be able to, its best usefulness is reinforcing people's current perspective. So, you know, again, the thing that we always fall back on is that even if you use negative or positive advertising, generally speaking, it reinforces loyalty. So if I'm already a Republican voter and I see, you know, something said, you know, something bad, an attack ad, it reinforces my belief system, but it won't change anybody, very rarely. So the solution, and it's a long-term investment. The first one is somehow building into the educational system an ability to think critically. Now, that's really hard. And, you know, because you have 4-year terms in Australia, we have 3-year terms for our federal government. And that's a really difficult thing. I think if I was advising the Democrats, I would say start the process by gently chipping away regularly at the falsities that are coming through as a consistent, ongoing program. So, you know, I think in a way, and then the next step, I think, if I was advising people, is to say, find the group of voters who are sitting on the fence, who are most likely to be able to be moved one way or the other. Do it in a way that's sophisticated. So don't go and ask people, are you a swing voter? Actually look at their behaviour. So, you know, in the past, you know, and look at things like their values and their kind of underlying motivations, the things that drive their behaviour. So that's the first thing. They're the people who are going to be the most easy or the easiest to convince to move. One of the things, and I'm a professor of marketing as well as consumer behaviour, one of the things that we always say about marketing is its role is actually to make it as easy as possible for your target market to make the decision that you would like them to make. It's not actually about pushing people who are never going to vote a particular way or buy your product or whatever to buy it. It's about saying, who are the people who there's some kind of barrier that is preventing them from doing the thing that we want them to do? That's actually really hard for a business to kind of get its head around, is that, well, not everybody loves them or loves their product or loves their party. I'm sure you as a politician, Mike, understand, are fine with that. Yeah. But I think one of the critical things here is to say, what is the barrier? What is preventing those people? I think, you know, like I admire Kamala Harris kind of coming out and talking about, you know, a woman's right over her body and things like that. I think that's a really important thing to be kind of talking about. But it's also about saying, so who are the people who are sitting on the fence here? What is it that's preventing them from voting for us? What are the incentives and the rewards for them to vote for us? Don't try and get everybody. Think about, and look, I'm probably saying stuff that's already spoken about in politics, but I'm always surprised at how businesses have this strategy and political parties have this strategy, which is really usually just a mass market strategy. And that what that means is that we just got to tell everybody what's good about us or what's bad about the opposition. It's actually, for me, it's about addressing those little 1% elements that say, what is the 1% thing that's preventing this person who's already predisposed to vote for us but just aren't voting for us? And the way you do that then is that you find out, and for me it's about values, it's about motivations, it's about the underlying principles that drive behaviour as opposed to demographics. And I think, again, polling companies and businesses have been fixated on demographics, things like age and income and things like that. What they haven't, because it's harder to measure, what they haven't measured is what motivates a person to do whatever it is that we're trying to get them to do. So what motivates a person to vote Democrat? What motivates a person to vote Republican? And under that, what are the values that drive that? Because values are those big foundational elements that drive a lot of our behaviour. But that is effortful. And you'll need, you know, as your consultant, I would say to you, you need to go and find a group of people who are much more sophisticated in their deep understanding of what it is to be human, to be able to then say, here is that little 1% of people in this particular kind of area that is already kind of predisposed to voting for your person, but they just need to have this element, whatever it is, or a few things, confirm for them that it's okay for them to do that. That's where the power lies, not in a huge mass campaign.
Well, and you know, I got to tell you, I had a very successful company where I did marketing for political people, and I was trained in a great company which used to send us for marketing training when I was in college as a salesperson, and they did exactly what you just said. They would tell us, look, we sold clothes. We sold very expensive men's clothes. And they say, look, the guy that's coming in the door wants to buy a suit. Your job is to make him feel comfortable with the decision to pay more for that suit than he would pay across the street at the discount place. And that's what it is. Your job's about making him feel comfortable. And everything this company did, they worked to enhance that with you. So, for example, we sold Cartier watches. I had to learn everything about a Cartier watch, who Cartier was, when they invented the wristwatch, what a tank watch was, how it worked, everything about it. But they wouldn't teach us anything about, let's say, Rolex watches. So the idea was that I could go on for 20 minutes telling you about the Cartier watch, and then if you said to me, well, what about a Rolex watch, I would say, well, I don't know anything about Rolex watches. And that would reinforce it to you, right? That obviously, if I know so much about the Cartier watch, if the Rolex watch was a damn, I'd know something about that too, wouldn't I? But, you know, that was the brilliance of what they did. It was always trying to make you feel comfortable with, you know, we used to say to people, 10% of the people that you know in life will see your car. 5% will see your house. But everybody sees the way you dress. If you want to make an impression on people, you got to dress right. And that was kind of our motivation. So, obviously, these guys were keyed into to that sort of thing. But it sounds like, to me, that this is a very slow process. It's going to take a very long time to get people to come around. You know, again, when you, I want to talk about the environment, how the environment affects you a little bit, because North Carolina is drowning, Florida's sinking into the ocean, California's on fire 24 hours a day. There are these ridiculous storms all over the world, and we've got a candidate out there saying, "Drill, baby, drill." What we need is more fossil fuel. We need to put more man-made pollutants in the air. And people are like, "Yeah, that's okay." So how does – I mean, is it the fact that we're detached from this kind of environment in the sense that if I don't live in Asheville, North Carolina, the flood really doesn't matter to me? Or if I don't live in Florida, or if I don't, you know, if I'm not in the wildfires, it really doesn't impact me. My environment has to be the immediate environment around me. It's
partially that. I mean, what you're saying is exactly right. The idea of the environment is, and this is why messaging around, well, it's, you know, it's snowing in Boston, so what's this thing about global warming, makes sense to a lot of people, because climate science for most people is abstract. Like, I went through university, I science kind of thing. I still don't fully understand the theory of relativity. I understand that it kind of sits underneath pretty much all physics kind of thing. But I remember sitting in a taxi driving, because I work for a university, sitting in a taxi driving past one of the universities in Sydney, and the taxi driver kind of looked across. I don't think he knew that I was a university professor, and he looked at the university and said, "Oh, the people there, they don't know anything." And it's kind of like, and people always talk about universities and, you know, scientists and things like that as living in ivory towers, as if we don't interact with the real world. But I think that is a useful way to think about how people see science. It's abstract. It doesn't seem to have a direct impact on their lives. So I think that's the first thing. I think the other thing is, it's called the risk as feelings thesis, this idea that basically we assess risk based on how we feel about something right now. And so, you know, ultimately, and you know, people determine their risk by what they can feel about something in the moment. And if in the moment they can't see the kind of climate change, in the moment they, even if you see a tornado, in the moment all that you're worried about is the immediate risk to your house or to your life or whatever. It's very difficult. And we kind of see this, is that people start to worry about climate change, for example, after a huge flood, but then in a way it kind of changes again. So again, I'm always kind of hesitant to give solutions to these things, because these are what we call wicked problems. They're so complex. But it is about then helping people to deeply understand how science affects their life. So over time they can go, actually, I can trust scientists. And, you know, as we kind of talked before we kind of came on air, my wife had leukemia. She died in 2017. For me, you know, it was like suddenly I realized that, yes, science itself is incredibly powerful and it can help us to understand things, but there's also things it can't do. It can't, you know, always save somebody's life. And I think that is, again, the trade-off that people are doing in their mind. They're going, well, science gets things wrong, so why should I trust it? But I think we get things wrong all the time. And the big thing for me when I talk to people about, you know, the idea of science and everything like that, is that knowledge itself is provisional, that the beautiful thing about science is that it's always updating. It's always saying, what are the holes in this theory? What do we need to add to this knowledge? Whereas what we've done is we've created a mentality, kind of a strongman mentality, which is it's wrong to ever admit that you're wrong. And I think, you know, there's a kind of a trend at the moment around vulnerable leadership, this idea that people need to feel okay with saying, I don't know what the answer to that is, but I want to kind of look for the, I want to look for the solution that, you know, is satisfactory, that at least gets us to the next step. And philosophers have been grappling with this for centuries, this idea of, you know, what is a form of truth? How do we solve these problems? This is partly why we look to gods. This is partly why we look to strong men, because it's that effect of saying, well, here's a person who gives me the feeling that they know what they're doing. And again, you know, it's sad that that's how the human brain is, but it's also the reality. It is that idea that we need to be able to give people, I think this is the thing, is that it's this risk as feelings concept. It's like, how do we give people enough information to say, this is the way, this is what's happening as a result of climate change or whatever. The big thing, and, you know, to get to that kind of how we might do it, one of the ways to do that is through narratives and storytelling. People are very much drawn to a story. That's kind of what, you know, even though we've kind of said it's not great, but anecdotes and stories are the useful way to get people to understand that. So again, storytelling is a really powerful way to move people towards thinking about things like climate change, thinking about the environment, thinking about how those things kind of influence their decision making.
Well, and, you know, politicians use it all the time, right? I can't remember who the first one was, whether it was Ronald Reagan, or I think it was Reagan, who pointed out people in the audience. In the audience, we have Joe Blow. You know, this was his experience. I think it's funny that they were saying the other day, I was listening to a news program, and they were saying that's one of the attractive things about Trump is he's a storyteller. And they said even at his rallies, tell stories, even though sometimes they're ridiculous, because he loves to tell the story about a woman that buys three apples and goes to the checkout, and she can't afford all three apples, so she takes one back and puts it back in the refrigerated case. And the speaker said, "How he doesn't even know that they don't keep apples in a refrigerated case." Okay?
Yeah.
I mean, but that doesn't matter to people. They go, they get the gist of the story, and that's just, it's just amazing to me that I'm a storyteller, so but it's amazing to me what people do. And, you know, I have a really clear understanding of who Donald Trump is because my father was a con man. My father was a nickel and dime who was always being chased by somebody for some scam that he was involved in. So, and our family was always hiding out when I was a kid. So, you know, I don't know why, maybe you can explain this to me, but my father could look you straight in the eye and say to you, "Paul, this $1,000 you're giving me, you're going to get it back next week. Don't worry about it." And even though he knew all the time that you weren't going to see a nickel of it. And I always thought that people bought this because the average person can't do this. The average person can't look you in the eye and take your hand and just bald-faced lie to you. And Trump's able to do that too. So what is it that makes us so accepting of that, you know? Yeah, any idea?
I think we do want to trust people. I think that's the first thing. I mean, I think the other thing, and it's interesting you should kind of mention the concept of the con man. I always kind of think about the magician and how they kind of do things and then they distract you. The whole idea of magic is distraction. And I think in a way, what even storytelling, Trump's kind of stories are very much a form of kind of the bread and circus idea, that idea of diverting people away from those kind of systemic issues that exist and actually giving them, I don't know, giving them a story. And I honestly think that most people don't believe most of what he is saying, but what it does is it's a great form of distraction. I think the mainstream media, I hate to say the word, but I think the mainstream media are also complicit in that, because their role, whether it's, you know, the New York Times or whatever, their role is to sell newspapers and advertising. the best thing they could do is to not take notice. That's going to be hard because that's not their objective. Their objective is to sell newspapers. So the reason that, you know, that this is able to be done is because we're always being distracted by what's going on. And I think what ends up happening then is, you know, to go back to your point about, you know, how can people look them in the eye? It becomes, as far as people, the truth ends up becoming not a real form of truth. I think it was Stephen Colbert kind of referred to it as truthiness. Like it's kind of like, you know, we know that you're not really telling the truth, but it's enjoyable and we're being distracted. And you see that, you know, you see people in the rallies and things like that. You know, I would imagine that a significant proportion of them go, well, yeah, you know, like he's just fun. He's a bit of a clown. Yeah. And that actually is that kind of, I don't know, that erosion of what we expect from our politicians, which is we've created a political approach which is about distracting people rather than actually saying we need people to engage with, you know, the democracy, engage with the republic. Now, I don't know if there's ever, you know, if I was to say make America great again, for me, the make America great again would be whenever there was a time that people were engaged with the country, as opposed to these kind of weird distractions about what, you know, what America looks like, what it pretended to look like. There's a concept that we kind of, you know, the rose-coloured glasses kind of approach, this idea of there was a perfect time when everything was, and we all know that, you know, everybody, well, certainly people who are engaged, but, you know, the whole concept of that idea is people do thirst. That's why we have nostalgia. People thirst for a better time. And then when people say to you, when they look you in the eye and they say, you know, you're going to get this back $2,000 more, people are hopeful. You know, most of what drives our behavior is very much hope, you know, hope in a better future, hope in a better life. The American idea is built around hope. So, you know, sometimes that idea of saying to somebody, vote for me or take this $1,000 or give me $1,000, I'll make it even better, is underpinned by a perception that I'm hopeful that it will happen. And that's, you know, what drives gamblers as well. It's what makes us human. Hopefulness is actually a good thing because it means we're optimistic about the future, but it also can be a really negative thing.
Well, that's a good note to end on, Doctor. I could talk to you all day about this stuff. It's fascinating. But since we're running out of time here, do you have a website or some way that people can look you up and check out your research and what you're doing? You want to give that to us? We'll post it for you.
I'm happy to. So I'm on all the social media. So I'm on Instagram. I'm not on X very much at all. But interestingly, if your audience, I'm not sure if they are, but I'm on TikTok as Dr. Paul Harrison, and that's where I kind of post a lot of video about the research I'm doing and the different theories that I grapple with. And also, yeah, feel, you know, like you could just do a search for Dr. Paul Harrison, Deakin University, and you'll find my work. But yeah, I think I've got about 75,000 followers on TikTok. It was a really interesting experience during the lockdowns where I just thought, I wonder if people are interested in human behavior. And it was just like, it just went crazy. And so I update that all the time. And some of the things that we've talked about today are, I've already kind of addressed things like why we kind of, you know, the false hope in information. I did do a post-election about the psychology of disappointment. And that's had quite a strong effect, following as well.
Yeah, I bet. There's a lot of disappointed people out there, Doctor. And you now have 75,001 TikTok followers. I'm certainly going to look you up. Thanks so much for being on.
Fantastic.
We leave. We end every show. We play out with a song. We dedicate it to our guests usually. This goes out to you, Doctor, and it goes out to all those people that voted for Donald Trump. Here's Sensation by The Who from the album Tommy. We'll see you next week. Thanks so much.
You know, before we go, I was in the first Australian production of Tommy.
Oh, you were? So you know the song Sensation. Yes. Yeah.
And I do indeed.
I couldn't think of any other song that would be more appropriate. So
it's very
thanks
true.
Again, Doctor. And
been a pleasure, Mike.
I'll be singing the score from Tommy out of tune for a very long time. So thanks so much for being on. And thanks, folks. We'll see you next week. Bye. Give the people their right to vote.